This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Ruling against TriMet.
And thousands of people in Cyprus awake this morning to discover the government taxed their bank accounts to cover a recent bailout.
Postal service is under attack. What do we do?
Stand up, fight back!
Postal service is under attack. What do we do?
Stand up, fight back!
Postal workers are under attack. What do we do?
Stand up, fight back!
That was sounds from a march and rally held in downtown Portland yesterday in support of postal workers. Over 600 people attended the event, including Portland Commissioner Amanda Fritz and Senators Jeff Merkley and Ron Wyden. The Postmaster General recently announced that Saturday mail delivery will end this August. In response, Portland organizer and retired letter carrier Jamie Partridge said, quote, "Congress needs to block these cuts and closures. The president should issue an executive order. The Postmaster General should be fired." KBOO's Old Mole Variety Show spoke with another Portland area retired letter carrier about her thoughts on the important role of regular mail service.
Letter carriers are literally blue-collar employees. We're middle-class people. You know, we don't earn a lot, but we earn enough to keep a roof over our heads, feed our families, and save enough money to send our children to college. And I want people to know that the Postal Service is the largest employer of veterans outside the military. And any cuts to service would be a cut to veterans' jobs and to middle-class jobs. And it's the middle class that supports, it's the infrastructure of our economy. We spend money, we earn money, we spend money. Yes, we do provide a very important service. We are a link within our community. Personally, I deliver to a very large mobile home park, and there's a lot of elderly people in my park, and they depend on me. They depend on me to be a contact. Sometimes the only thing they, or the only people they talk to is me. You know, because they don't have a lot of family left. They depend on me for their medication, for their correspondence. I check on them, you know, when I go by their homes, make sure they're okay. And we tell each other what's going on in the community. We take care of each other. And I think that's really lost in our community of internet and telephones and computers, that we don't have that personal connection. Any private organization always looks for the cream of the crop. And that's what they're going to do. They may skim off the very high income areas, but those poor people and those people in rural areas, their service or lack thereof, the prices are going to skyrocket because the private market can determine and change prices on a whim. Whereas if the Postal Service wants to change a price, it takes over a year. We have to go through meetings and hearings and justify it, and everybody gets a chance to comment. A UPS, FedEx can change their price overnight without answering to anybody. Because we're federal employees, we're not allowed to discriminate or say, oh, I don't like this neighborhood or I don't like that customer, and so I'm going to deny them service. We can't do that. We serve everybody equally. And that's something that a private company will not do. Rural communities really depend on the Postal Service as a conduit for what's going on in their community. Usually the small post offices especially, that's the only link to bigger cities and outside areas and big companies like Amazon to get things to them, is to go through their Postal Service to get service. And that's something that would... Some rural areas might have to travel 10, 15, 20, 30 miles to the nearest post office if the small post offices close.
That was a retired Portland area letter carrier speaking at yesterday's rally. Other protests against mail service cuts took place across the country this weekend, including in San Francisco and New Haven. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, March 18th, 2013, and I'm Serena Fong.
And I'm John Rasmussen. On Friday, the Employment Relations Board, or ERB, ruled against TriMet regarding a dispute with the transit union over health care expenses. The board denied a motion to stay an order issued last December, which required TriMet to reimburse employees for lost wages and benefits from unlawful conduct that occurred in 2011. According to the Transit Workers Union, TriMet raised health insurance premiums in retaliation to a previous union complaint, which accused the transit agency of negotiating in bad faith. In addition to the reimbursement, the board also ordered TriMet to email a notice of violations to its employees and post it for 30 days. In late January, the trans agency filed a motion to delay the order, claiming that the order would cause irreparable injury to the agency. According to a notice sent to TriMet and the workers' union on Friday, the ERB was unable to establish how the order would harm the agency, stating that any harm at all was speculative in nature. For more, we go to KBOO's Rebecca Ney, who spoke with Bruce Hansen, president of the Amalgamated Trans Union 757.
So since TriMet lost its latest appeal, what happens now?
Well, this decision is based upon another appeal. We're not sure whether they will appeal this decision or not, but it's subject to another appeal if they choose to do so.
How does this fight over health care benefits relate to the recent news about TriMet's fare increases?
This would be part of the unfair labor practice we have pertaining to acting as a retaliatory factor. They charged our members approximately $3.6 million. So it would be an additional $3.6 million on their budget.
So now TriMet has blamed a lot of their fare increases on these healthcare expenses that the union is asking for. What do you believe are the reasons behind these fare increases?
Well, as we're finding out, back in 2011, they did a fare system migration, and they're actually at the same rate that they wanted to be back at and discussed in 2011.
That was Bruce Hansen, president of the Amalgamated Transit Union 757. Hansen was referring to a $16 million fare collection system that, according to the union, TriMet instituted fare increases to pay for. In a press release issued today, the union cites evidence from a 64-page document from an anonymous source indicating that last year's fare increases, as well as the elimination of zone pricing and fareless square, was undertaken to fund the collection system. According to a report today in the Portland Tribune, TriMet has started installing new ticketing machines on its buses, with a goal of having a new machine in every bus by May 1st.
Governor John Kitzhaber signed a new bill today, creating a mediation process for patients injured by medical malpractice. Senate Bill 483 is meant to limit costly malpractice lawsuits by allowing patients to enter into a private dialogue with a doctor to discuss a settlement. The bill allows the patient or the healthcare provider to file a Notice of Adverse Healthcare Incident report with the Oregon Patient Safety Commission without assuming liability. The commission then notifies the other party, at which point they may enter into discussions and mediations overseen by the commission, which could include settlement offers. William Pierce, president of the Oregon Medical Association, attended today's signing ceremony. He says the new system will help improve healthcare delivery by encouraging more open discussions when things do go wrong.
A local nonprofit has created a currency for the homeless. Sanctity of Hope makes and distributes tokens that can be redeemed at participating businesses. Sanctity of Hope's executive director says the tokens were created to give people the ability to donate to those in need while not having to be concerned with how the money will be spent. There are about 12 businesses on board so far, which includes restaurants, clothing stores, laundry services, and bike repair shops. The tokens cost $1 each and can be purchased at givetokens.org.
The American Chemical Council is officially opposing an Oregon bill aimed at eliminating toxic substances in children's products. A spokesperson for the Chemical Council said they are concerned the bill would unnecessarily alarm parents about some children's products. The new House bill would require the Oregon Health Authority to maintain and publish a list of chemicals of concern that are used in children's products, as well as the associated health impacts of those chemicals. The bill would also require manufacturers to stop using the chemicals within 5 years of the chemical being placed on the list. Manufacturers can apply for a waiver if they have proof the chemical is not toxic or if they cannot find a good substitute. In 2011, Oregon's legislature failed to pass a bill that would have banned BPA, a known hormone disruptor shown to be detrimental to the brain and the reproductive system. Proponents of the new bill, which is modeled after a similar Washington state law, says this one takes a more scientific approach to regulation than the last proposed bill and hope this will improve its chances of being passed into law.
Oregon lawmakers today heard testimony from supporters of a House bill which would give workers up to 2 weeks of leave to mourn the death of a relative. The bill would add grieving to a list of family concerns, including illness and childbirth, which allows workers time off without penalty. A similar bill passed the Senate in 2011 but stalled in the House. Business groups opposed the bill argued that providing leave to employees who had lost a loved one could put undue strain on employers.
A new survey conducted by AARP Oregon reveals that most seniors value choice about how and where they receive elder care, but ongoing budget cuts and service cutbacks have undermined that ability. In conjunction with the Oregon News Service, KBOO's Evan Owen Stively has more.
Oregonians over 50 are concerned enough about aging gracefully that long-term care services and supports rank second on their list of top priorities, right behind the economy and jobs. That comes from a new statewide survey by AARP Oregon. 90% of those surveyed said it's important to have choices for how and where they receive care, and 58% said they prefer their own home or an assisted living arrangement. But Jerry Cohen, AARP Oregon State Director, says when state budget cuts continue to chip away at social services, it becomes harder to stay independent and to age with dignity.
That's what we're fighting for, and I think that's what our survey validates. It's common sense, but it's nice to know that the majority of Oregonians, certainly the AARP members responding here, also share that and validate that vision.
Governor Kitzhaber's budget doesn't trim services for seniors and people with disabilities, but the budget proposed by the Ways and Means Committee co-chairs in Salem includes some cuts. AARP Oregon says that it will share the survey results with lawmakers and stress the need to plan for a future in which about 70% of those who are now 65 or older will need some type of long-term care. In the survey, 59% of respondents said they'd rather have in-home care professionals than rely on family or friends. Cohen says that's partly because relatives aren't always nearby, or they don't want to feel like a burden. More than one-third of AARP members say they are already caring for aging loved ones, and Cohen says support services for those families are also disappearing.
In Oregon, we'd had a wonderful, vibrant respite system of care for caregivers, but we've pretty much chopped out and eliminated so much of that support, and so that adds again to the concern and stress.
He says that the greatest need for services is in the fastest-growing segment of the senior population, those over age 85. That group will grow by 50% in Oregon in the next decade, and AARP says allowing them to be cared for at home is the state's least expensive option.
That was KBOO's Evan Owen Stively in conjunction with the Oregon News Service.
Today, the City of Portland office announced plans to consider amending the city's controversial new arts tax. Portlanders approved the arts tax last November, which required all except low-income adults to pay $35 annually for local arts programs. The $12 million in revenue goes to elementary schools to pay for arts teachers as well as cultural grants. Critics say the tax is regressive because everyone with a source of income would be required to pay the fee, even if they live in a household below the poverty line. As a solution, Mayor Hales has proposed an amendment requiring an annual income threshold of at least $1,000 in order to pay the tax. Portland's City Council will consider the emergency measure on March 27th. If passed, the measure would take effect immediately, and the city's revenue bureau would refund those who qualify but had already paid the tax.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio news at 5:30. Followed by Labor Radio, discussions on working class issues at 6. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Tonight's show looks into Cascade AIDS Project, the oldest and largest community-based provider of HIV services in Oregon and Southwest Washington. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is expected to be intermittently sunny and cloudy, with showers likely in the later afternoon, highs near 51 degrees. The evening should be a little rainy and windy, lows around 49.
It's 5:17, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
In a recent senatorial dust-up, Senator John McCain dubbed his Republican colleague Rand Paul one of the, quote, wacko birds in Congress. McCain, who sometimes appears not too tightly wrapped himself, was giving Senator Paul a tongue-lashing for having mounted a 13-hour old-fashioned standalone filibuster over the possibility that murderous drones could be used for targeted assassinations of Americans right here at home. McCain said that the Kentucky senator's talkathon had veered into, quote, the realm of the ridiculous, adding that, I don't think it is helpful to the American people. I hate to interrupt when one Republican Solon is hammering another, but I'm siding with Rand Paul. While plenty of the Tea Party senators' extreme right-wing stands are wacko, this isn't one of them. Unfortunately for America, powerful corporate interests are eager to reap billions in profit from the spread of drones across our land, and police agencies at all levels are drooling at the prospect of adding weaponized fleets of drones to their arsenals. Indeed, what's ridiculous is that other Congress critters have not been paying attention, speaking out, and taking action. Call it grandstanding if you want, but at least Paul took an actual stand. And, contrary to McCain's opinion, it was quite helpful to the American people. Thanks to Paul's attention-getting combination of principle, ego, and chutzpah, the great majority of Americans heard for the first time that these inherently invasive, liberty-busting, and potentially deadly drones are on the verge of being deployed domestically. This is Jim Hightower saying, that's why the Congressional Progressive Caucus and such alert Democrats as Senator Ron Wyden have joined in sounding the alarm and demanding a full public debate on the cost to our democracy before we let profiteers unleash this technology on us. As Senator Paul says, at least we need to know what are the rules.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
In Cyprus this Saturday, the government taxed bank accounts to partially cover the cost of a recent financial bailout brokered by Germany. People woke up this morning to discover that $1.16 had been collected from their bank accounts. Wealthy depositors had $1 and $10 taxed from their accounts. Germany has agreed to provide $13 billion in bailout funds, with tax increases covering another $7.5 billion. Depositors have been given bank stocks as compensation. International observers have warned of a run on banks as depositors rush to avoid future appropriation, but financial markets have been mostly stable following the crisis. Banks were closed as part of a national holiday today, and the government further postponed their opening until Wednesday. Cyprus's banks are considered a tax haven for wealthy Russian investors. The country's banks hold revenue that is 8 times larger than Cyprus's gross domestic product. Cyprus also invested heavily in Greek debt, but sustained substantial losses during the Greek debt crisis in 2012.
On Sunday afternoon, two inmates in a Quebec jail escaped by boarding a hijacked helicopter, which lowered rope to the prisoners while they were in the jail yard. Both prisoners Benjamin Houdin Barbeau and Daddy Provincial from the St. Jerome jail have since been caught. Prison authorities later located the helicopter along with the stolen aircraft pilot, who was taken to a hospital for treatment. Authorities believe he was taken hostage and is not complicit in the jailbreak. Police also arrested two other people in connection with the escape. Using a helicopter for a prison escape is not an unheard-of tactic. French prisoner Pascal Payet has escaped custody by helicopter 3 times over the past decade, and American businessman Joel David Kaplan escaped a Mexican jail in 1971 in the same way. Prison escapes via helicopter have also occurred in Brazil, Belgium, Greece, Chile, and Australia.
The main political opposition to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's regime met in Istanbul, Turkey today to formally establish an alternative government. The opposition government, the Syrian National Coalition, would elect a prime minister to govern rebel-held areas in the embattled country. The U.S. has previously stressed a political changeover in Syria via a transition government that would negotiate Assad's replacement, but opposition leaders have remained steadfast in their refusal to negotiate with Assad. Also on Monday, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said that the United States would not prevent other countries from arming Syrian rebels. Both the United Kingdom and France have said they'll push the European Union to lift its arms embargo on Syria and be able to begin arming Syrian rebels immediately. The U.S. had formally officially stood against sending arms to Syria. It has pledged to send non-lethal aid in the form of food rations and medical supplies. The civil war in Syria erupted in March of 2011 as part of the Arab Spring, popular protests which deposed rulers in Tunisia and Egypt. The Assad government responded to protests in Syria with deadly force, which precipitated an armed revolt. An estimated 70,000 people have been killed since the war began, and 4 million people have been displaced. Today, 26 people were killed in shelling in Damascus, and Syrian fighter jets bombed targets near the border of Lebanon.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, on Saturday, a U.S. helicopter crashed outside of Kandahar City, killing one coalition service member and injuring another. It is the second deadly crash in Afghanistan in a week, after five U.S. soldiers died in a Black Hawk helicopter accident last Monday. On Sunday, the Department of Defense released the identities of those five U.S. soldiers, although there is still no word on the cause of the crash. Also on Sunday, Staff Sergeant Robert Bales, accused of killing 16 Afghan civilians, began a sanity review to determine his ability to stand trial. Over the weekend, several hundred civilians in Afghanistan protested U.S. Special Forces activities in the Wardak province. They claim that U.S. soldiers are torturing, killing, and kidnapping in the region, something that the Department of Defense denies. The demonstrations were bolstered by President Hamid Karzai's demand last week that U.S. Special Forces leave the area. U.S. officials hope turning Bagram Prison over to Afghan control will allow for a deal that lets U.S. forces to continue operating in the region. In related news, Spain has moved forward on plans to pull troops from Afghanistan, withdrawing their remaining forces to a base in Herat province. 46 Spanish soldiers will return home in the near future, with a total withdrawal by 2014.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Monday, March 18, 2013. Troops attack residents in southern West Bank and political detainees held by Israel announce a hunger strike. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Dozens of residents were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation on Monday during clashes that erupted between local youth and Israeli troops at Al Arub refugee camp to the north of the southern West Bank city of Hebron. Local sources reported that Israeli soldiers stormed the entrance of the camp and fired tear gas at residents, then local youth responded by hurling stones at them. Medical sources said that dozens of residents received treatment for the effects of tear gas inhalation. Last week, Israeli troops shot and killed a local journalist during clashes at Al Arub refugee camp. Also in southern West Bank, Palestinian protesters set fire to U.S. President Barack Obama's photos on Monday in the city of Bethlehem, local sources reported. Speaking to the local radio station Bethlehem 2000, one of the protesters said that the act is symbolic, adding that they are replacing Obama's photos with signs demanding an end to the Israeli occupation and freedom for Palestinian political detainees, as well as the freeze of settlement construction on Palestinian lands in the West Bank. In other news, Palestinian political detainees held by Israel at the Nafha Military Detention Center announced on Monday that they are holding a one-day hunger strike on Tuesday. The prisoners announced that they are protesting the Israeli ongoing ill treatment and in solidarity with Samer al-Isawi, who is on hunger strike since 7 months. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, March 18th News Roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Hossam Kassis and me, Bassam Bannoura.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032.
Our production team for tonight's newscast is Mike Klepfer, Robin Ryan, Evan Owen Stively, Matt Maddox, and Zeke Harrington. The producer is Serena Fong. Our engineer is Danielle Parks, and the interim KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Rebecca Ney.
A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with.
The local number of Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. And Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K264AA Corvallis, 100.7 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM.
I'm John Rasmussen.
And I'm Serena Fong. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with Abe Proctor and Joe Uris.
At 9, an alternative radio independent journalist, Christopher D. Bellier, speaks on Iran, coups, sanctions, and threats of war. At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein.
At 11, on stage and studio, host D. Mae Roberts looks at Milagro Theater's Guapa, an inspiring tale of a young woman's dream to be an international soccer star. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, Joseph Gallivan will interview Portland artist James Minden about his current exhibition of handmade holograms titled Real Unreal.
Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a KBOO member, please go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today.
And stay tuned now for more international and national news from the worker-run collective at Free Speech Radio News. Good night, John.
Good night, Serena.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, March 18th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, the Supreme Court hears a challenge to Arizona's law requiring proof of citizenship to register to vote. In Detroit, religious leaders and community activists protest the governor's appointment of an emergency manager for the city, calling it undemocratic and a threat to labor rights. And we'll go to San Francisco, where activists and workers join a nationwide effort to save the U.S. postal system. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. According to Rwanda's foreign minister, a leader of the M23 rebels in the Democratic Republic of Congo, indicted by the International Criminal Court, is in the U.S. Embassy in Kigali. Former Congolese General Bosco Ntaganda is wanted on charges including murder, attacks against civilians, rape, sexual slavery, and conscripting child soldiers. The United States still has not signed on to the International Criminal Court. There's no word yet from the U.S. State Department. In Lakeland, Florida, more than 1,000 farm workers and their allies finished up a 200-mile, two-week march. Their final destination is the corporate home of one of the country's largest grocery chains. The marchers arrived there Sunday and called on public supermarkets to support human rights for Florida tomato pickers. Linka Davis was there.
Publix, escucha, estamos en la lucha.
Publix, listen, we are struggling, the protesters shout as they approach the Publix headquarters, calling for the corporation to join the Fair Food Program. The program protects the workers from sexual harassment, discrimination, physical and verbal abuse, and wage theft. It also guarantees workers a wage increase of a penny per pound of harvested tomatoes. Jordan Buckley from the group Interaction, which co-sponsored the march with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, says while 11 major food corporations, including McDonald's, Burger King, and Whole Foods, are already participating in the program, Publix still refuses to join.
Publix continues to purchase from at least two farms that are among the fewer than 10% of the Florida tomato industry that has rejected the Fair Food Program, that continues these policies that have resulted in sexual harassment, have resulted in unfair compensation for hours worked, where a blind eye is turned to all sorts of violence and other types of abuse in the field.
Shannon Patton, the spokesperson for Publix, did not respond to requests for comment. In a statement, Publix claims the issue is a labor dispute between the farm workers and their employers. Lenka Davis, FSRN, Lakeland, Florida.
The investigation of an August rape in Steubenville, Ohio, continues after a juvenile judge convicted two young men in the attack yesterday. 16-year-old Malik Richmond and 17-year-old Trent Mays were sentenced to at least 1 and 2 years, respectively, in juvenile detention. They'll also have to register as sex offenders. Had they been tried as adults, they could have received much longer sentences. Last August, a 16-year-old girl was raped twice in the same night. Pictures and a video of the attack then circulated on social media. After the verdicts, Ohio's Attorney General Mike DeWine said the investigation into the sexual attack is ongoing.
While we have interviewed almost 60 individuals, 16 people refused to talk to our investigators. I have reached the conclusion that we cannot bring finality to this matter without the convening of a grand jury.
The grand jury will meet in mid-April, which could result in additional indictments. A Tibetan monk and a woman both torched themselves to death in a Tibetan area of China's Sichuan province in recent days. This month marks both the 1959 exile of the Dalai Lama and the fifth anniversary of violent protests against Chinese rule that spread from Lhasa to other Tibetan areas of the country. Rebecca Valley has more from Beijing.
According to foreign media reports, 28-year-old Lobsang Tokmei set himself on fire in his room at the Kirti Monastery on Saturday. The monk then ran to the compound's entrance with a Tibetan flag in his hands. He died later the same day. Naba Prefecture and the local Kirti Monastery have been the center of many demonstrations against China's rule since 2008. Earlier in the week, 31-year-old Kunkal Gwangmo self-immolated. According to Tibetan rights group Free Tibet, her act of protest was initially kept secret by authorities and her body quickly cremated. Last week's dramatic burnings come as China wraps up its once-in-a-decade leadership transition with a new government led by Xi Jinping. Free Tibet's Alistair Curry says that China's repressive rule over Tibetans is unsustainable.
Realistically, the new Chinese regime has to take an approach which involves ending human rights abuses in Tibet and engaging in dialogue with the representatives of the Tibetan people.
Curry says that unless China changes its policy in the region, Tibetans will continue to self-immolate. Rebecca Valley, Free Speech Radio News, Beijing.
Police in Zimbabwe did not release a prominent human rights